Welcome to the Build Wealth Canada podcast, where it's all about becoming debt-free, accelerating your wealth, and taking control of your money. Now, here's your host, Cornell Schreiber.
Hey, it's Cornell, and welcome to the Build Wealth Canada show. When it comes to managing our investment portfolios, there are definitely some mistakes that are easy to make and ones that a lot of Canadian investors tend to make. In this episode, we have Peter McMurtry on the show, who is going to take us through what the common mistakes are that Canadian investors tend to make. Peter has over 30 years of experience in the industry, and one of the things he does is portfolio reviews for his clients. So I wanted to pick his brain on the common mistakes that he sees investors make when he reviews their portfolios so that you and I can be sure to avoid these mistakes in our own portfolios. Now, on the flip side, he's also worked with clients that are successful investors. And after doing this for 30 plus years, one begins to notice certain patterns about what the successful investors do that the unsuccessful don't. And so we go into these best practices that he's noticed over the years from these successful investors so that we can apply these lessons ourselves. Now, a quick little caveat about this episode, a lot of these lessons and best practices that we're going to cover today will apply to both passive index investors like myself and active investors too. But Peter is a bit more on the active side when it comes to investing. So you will hear a bit more mentions in regard to picking individual stocks as well, as opposed to just passive. But I thought it would be good to leave that in so that we can get a broader perspective, even if myself and many of us listening are passive index investors where we don't actually pick individual stocks. Now, a quick little bio about Peter before we start. Peter has spent the last 30 plus years working in the investment industry and the financial industry. He's a CFA and has written articles for the Globe and Mail, Canadian Money Saver magazine. He's also the author of the book, Own Your Financial Future, which is available on Amazon. And he also writes a monthly newsletter called the McMurtry Investment Report. And now let's get into the show. All right, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Peter, I noticed that one of the things you do is portfolio reviews, where you examine a person's investment portfolio and then advise them on the improvements that they can make to it. When you review portfolios like this, what are some of the top mistakes that you see people make?
When they come to me to do a portfolio review, it's usually because it's portfolios in bad shape. What I do notice the most frequently is clients come to me with some advisor cookie cutter model account of mutual funds and or exchange traded funds or whatever. The clients do not really know what's they're invested in. They do not know their asset mix. They do not know a lot about their investment, generally the risk associated. And more importantly, if they have three or four accounts, there's no consolidated asset mix. So they have no idea what they're really overall invested in, and it makes them very confused and very nervous. Those are some of the things I see in that. In terms of common mistakes, I also notice the clients have very large positions in one stock for various reasons. One, the stock has obviously done very well over time. I had a subscriber that had Apple, and Apple did tremendously well, but it represented 60% of his portfolio. So it distorted the performance. And when the stock did fall, his performance really suffered. So it's important to diversify that list, to trim back. If a stock becomes more than 10% of the total equity holdings, I always trim back and switch the proceeds into other areas of the market that haven't grown as much to properly diversify. It's all about reducing risk. I also see clients that invested with only common stocks, regardless of the age of the client. It's important to have some cash and some fixed income as a sort of a cash hedge, just in case the market falls. And it's very important to have that because you can rebalance. If the market falls, you can invest more in equities after they decline. If you're fully invested, there's nowhere to hide.
Before you go on, when it comes to that cash hedge, there's so many options out there when it comes to the non-equity side of the portfolio. Are there any that you tend to steer towards, that you tend to like, that you think are effective at being that cash hedge?
I try to stay away from, for the most part, GICs, particularly right now. With interest rates at relatively high levels right now, investing in a GIC does not give you flexibility to make a change in asset mix when the opportunity develops. So I like to keep the cash component short and make a switch and liquid. So for example, short-term bonds, which you get on your discount brokerage site, that don't fluctuate very much. There are some ETFs that are very short-term that are high quality that you can liquidate anytime. GICs, I see a lot of clients going to GICs right now, and they can't change their asset mix when it warrants to. So say if equities were to fall 10%, they can't suddenly liquidate that GIC until it matures without incurring a penalty of all the interest. So that's what I see.
Gotcha. In terms of lessons learned, you mentioned that a lot of times when clients come to you for these portfolio reviews, they have all these, sounds like investments that they've accumulated over the years, and it's no longer this nice structured optimized thing. It sounds like there's just a lot in there, and then they're looking to get a good handle on it. How can they, for everybody listening, all the Canadians listening, how can we as investors prevent ourselves from getting in that situation? Do you have any advice on that?
Trim back a position. So if you really like a stock and the sector, I'm not saying to go to zero, but trim back a little. So it doesn't get over 10%. You never get killed if something happens. If you have too much in one stock, you can do very well for a period of time and then very badly. So by trimming back, it's a discipline. So you're selling when it's already gone up. Mm-hmm. You're not selling when it's down, you're selling when it's up. The reverse of this is that many years ago, I had a client that had Nortel stock. They didn't want to sell. And I suggested, they had 50% of their portfolio in Nortel. And I suggested selling, and the person didn't want. And they ended up, they're beneficiaries of this individual who passed away. That individual refused to sell Nortel, and the beneficiary suffered for the rest of their lives because of that one decision. So it's very important to be cognizant of risk and never have too much in any one stock. Many years ago, a very wise portfolio manager told me, the strength of a really good portfolio manager is not shown in an up market, but in a down market. So the really good portfolio managers focus on the risk and the volatility of the portfolio. In an up market, they're not going to chase stocks that are like very small cap or very risky because they think it's dangerous. So they won't necessarily perform as well in the upside, but they'll perform substantially better on the downside.
I had started asking you some follow-up questions there. Did you have any other points that you wanted to mention in regards to the first question in terms of top mistakes that you see, or did we already cover all of them?
Some clients are either over or underexposed to a particular equity sector. Every month in my newsletter, I publish the benchmark U.S. and Canadian equity subsector weights, and they're available online for free. And they give you at least a benchmark to deal with. And so if you like a sector, it's 10% of the benchmark, and you may be at 12% or 13%, and if you don't like it, it could be a 7%. But you always have some exposure, so you have a range to work within, but you're never zero exposure. Because by having zero exposure to a group you may not like, you're chasing it when it starts to pick up. So I see a lot of clients only have exposure to one sector and nothing in anything else. An example would be even the senior portfolio managers, even governments. For example, the Norway Sovereign Fund, which basically is an oil-rich country and was an oil producer, they cut back on having no energy exposure several years ago. And by not having any exposure to one sector, look what happened. It is important to have exposure to all sectors, but you can work within a range so that you're not overexposed and you're not underexposed. You have a little bit of everything. So you're making a lot of small bets and things, and the same thing with asset mix. Yeah. You can have a tactical asset mix approach, but for the cash, for the fixed income, for the equity, depending on your long-term objectives. So even a conservative client can have obviously more equity at certain times. And when you think there's going to be a recession, you have less equity. So you have a range to work within.
Are there any other mistakes you want to cover before we move on to the next question?
Yeah, the other one is a lot of investors have a mismatch on stocks that they either their neighbor recommended a stock, the chart is going up, the technical chart, or there's a takeover round. And they've amassed these companies that have nothing to do with each other. They're not really a blend of a portfolio, and the quality is lacking. In some cases, they may be stocks that have no earnings, no revenue, and you're just buying them based on some premise of whatever. This was the case many years ago with the Canada stocks. When they first came out the industry, they had no revenues, no cash flow, no earnings, and yet people were investing, making a lot of money without really doing any fundamental analysis. So they ended up with a portfolio of stocks that ended up going, in many cases, bankrupt. So it's very important to do the fundamental analysis of what's going on. There are exceptions to this rule, by the way. Amazon and Uber, as an example, both are companies that for many years showed strong revenue growth, but no earnings or cash flow. Just a matter of time, though, before they did report, and Uber is now coming into a cash flow positive and earnings positive for the first time. Amazon took many years, but obviously they're very profitable now. What I'm talking about are companies that have no revenues, no revenue growth, and no revenue. And people are buying them based on some speculation. Those are things that are dangerous.
Yeah, it sounds like people getting caught up in the hype. And yeah, like with the cannabis being a good example where, oh, it's becoming legalized in Canada, so let's jump on board the train, and not even really looking at the valuations and things of that nature, just because it just seems like a sure thing, which it never is, unfortunately.
Never runs.
Exactly. But, awesome. So is that it for, you would say, the most common mistakes that you see? Great. And now a quick intermission to tell you about an additional free resource that you may find helpful. On this podcast, we often cover best practices that can not only help you now, but will also be relevant throughout your investment lifetime. But what if you also want an update on what is happening with your investments, the markets, and the economy right now? So to help me stay up to date on these topics, a great Canadian podcast that I listen to weekly is called Views from the Desk. They provide timely information for us Canadians on what is happening to our investments right now, as well as other key factors affecting us, like changes to our interest rates, our inflation, and regulatory changes that we should know about here in Canada. The podcast is hosted by BMO ETFs. I'm a huge fan of theirs. I own a lot of BMO ETFs myself, and it's a great resource for both new and existing ETF investors. I hope you check them out. All episodes are available for free in your favorite podcast player. Just search for Views from the Desk. Now, let's get back into the interview. Now, from doing these portfolio reviews and from working in the industry for over 30 years, have you noticed certain patterns in terms of best practices from those that tend to manage their investment portfolios really well?
Yes, ones that are very well diversified by asset mix, by individual stock, by equity sectors, and also by fixed income. The fixed income area is an example. People just think fixed income is fixed income. You don't need to diversify, you do. Some fixed income ETFs are only basically poor credits, which is obviously dangerous. Some fixed income investments are only long-term bonds, which is obviously much more volatile. So it's important to analyze fixed income as well. So from best practices point of view, best portfolio managers I see really diversify that risk. And they also focus on quality stocks, and they don't tend to play speculative stocks. And if they do, it's a very small percentage of the portfolio, say 1% of the equity content they may put on a flyer. If something happens that doesn't affect the portfolio, they don't put much into it. And that's best practices in terms of that. The other thing is that they make a lot of small bets as opposed to one large one. What I mean by that is not only the stocks you pick, but the equity sectors you pick, all of these things, you don't make major calls. You make a lot of small calls. So when you make a change, you could be making a small change, but that change will improve the portfolio. For example, when you have a stock in your portfolio that's high quality and they have a bad quarter, best practices portfolio manager would analyze the company and the industry that they're in and the economic where are we in the economic cycle? And say, for example, Stantec. A couple of weeks ago, they announced quarter. It wasn't as good as expected. The stock fell. But the long-term outlook is very favorable. And the earnings per share revisions, which you put the analysts revise over the last month, trending up, it just had a bad quarter. As long as it's only a bad quarter, the stock is probably on sale. So I ended up buying more of Stantec after it declined. But normally what I do is I wait a couple of days for the churning or selling to take place. And once the selling stops, then it starts to go, it levels out and goes back up. So those are some of the things, but it's all to do with controlling the risk. And the best portfolio managers look at the risk-adjusted rate of return. So it's not trying to maximize the rate of return, but it's trying to control the risk. You want to achieve consistency of return, not just absolute return.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed just from my experience and speaking with other active investors who are quite good at what they do, that it's not like when I first started in this industry, I thought, okay, these top active investors, they probably 90% of their, and it's just arbitrary number I thought of in my head at the time. I thought, oh, maybe 90% of their picks are really good picks and they actually do quite well. And then once I actually got to know them and see their portfolios and see their performance, what I've noticed is that basically it's aligned with what you're saying, how it's not like they have this win rate of like 90%+. They, even the best ones, do make investments and they actually don't do well at all. But they do, if they're good enough, it seems like they will eventually pick some of these ones, you know, they get an early on the Apple or the Shopify, you know, those kinds of things, yes. Right? Like the Constellation Software, like those kinds of companies. And then those are the ones that really do well. And those offset all those smaller bets that they got wrong. So it's like the small bet actually turns into a big win, but the small bets that fail don't hurt as much because they're small bets. At least that's the pattern that I've noticed. And it was very surprising to me because I thought the win rate would be higher, but it's not, that doesn't seem to be the case. It's just the winners do really well, but you're also kind of spreading things around so the losses don't destroy you. It sounds like you found it this similar kind of situation.
Absolutely. Yeah? Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. One thing I learned this many years ago, when I first got into business, give an example, I was working in Bermuda. So I was running a U.S. equity portfolio. This is a long time ago. This is like 30 years ago. And the market was dropping. And so I averaged down in the stock, and it was a technology stock. So my dad phoned me, and he said, how's it going? I said, I'm doing okay, but I said that I lost a little bit in the stock. It was 30,000 down or something. So he phoned me back in an hour, and he said, did you invest that money yourself? Is that your money that you lost? I said, no, that's a pension fund. Oh, he says, that's okay then. So the thing I learned from that, though, was averaging down in the stock in decline. You have to be very vigilant of what you're averaging down, what type of stock it is, what industry they're in. Are there any other future things that can go wrong with the company? It's a tip of the iceberg type thing. So you really have to do your fundamental research at that time. And averaging down is actually increasing your risk.
Maybe define careful. What averaging down means for anybody that's new to the terminology.
If you're buying a stock and then it falls and you buy more because so you're lower on your cost. So I did that with Stantec, but I know Stantec is in a growing industry. They're doing very well. They had a bad quarter. The next quarter will be fine. The earnings per share are being revised up. So that was okay. But if you average down into a stock that's in a major decline, I'll give an example would be a company that really was doing tremendously well. And then all of a sudden they had a bad quarter for the first time. If you think that quarter is going to continue, then you want to back up until you're sure that it's not a one-shot quarter, that they can get their act together. So what I often do is to send a note to the company itself and say, is it a short-term problem? Is it a long-term problem? And depending on how they answer, and how quickly they ask, it is important to determine what I do with the stock. And I had one the other day fell, and I got an answer from the company, say the name of the company, but no, I don't want to say, but their answer was, what bothered me is they didn't answer me for 2 weeks. And so I sent it to another person in the company. So the whole company was on holiday for 2 weeks. That bothers me. So by the time I got an answer, the answer was very vague. But I didn't sell it. I just didn't buy any more. So until I'm more comfortable with it, like the long term of the company, but the short term, I'm a little bit concerned. So by averaging down, you got to be careful. And you got to do more homework averaging down than you're just buying a stock when it's going up.
Right, because you're saying it might be an opportunity. Sure, if it's just some temporary thing, like some bad PR, some people are panic selling when really the company is actually still on solid footing. But you, like you said, you've got to do that extra layer of due diligence, it sounds like. Because maybe they actually are selling for a good reason. Yeah, that
makes exactly.
Sense. Gotcha. Are there any other points you want to cover on that one in terms of best practices? Or does that cover the main points you had?
I also said portfolio management experience tend not to invest in new industries until they're more mature. They tend not to invest in cannabis industry. They tend, on average, they're changing a little bit, but in Bitcoin, they're still pretty apprehensive from the volatility. And as you said before, you listen to these Bitcoin strategists and they think there's no downside.
Yeah.
They say that, oh, there's limited supply and everyone can make money. This just isn't true. So a lot of senior portfolio managers stay away from these industries until they're more comfortable with what's going on, including Warren Buffett. I don't think he'll ever buy Bitcoin, but because he's not comfortable with the fundamentals of the industry. He doesn't think he thinks there's a long hype. I also see portfolio managers very leery of funds that promise the moon in returns. I came across one the other day, and they said that the dividend yield is 15%. Now, I just don't believe that. And they say it's a conservative investment. And they use they write call options, gives you a slight incremental return. They use leverage, though, which is dangerous, and that's risky. And they also, and they don't mention this, but part of the dividend return is return of capital. But they don't highlight this. It's in the back pages. So this is like a Bernie Madoff type forensic accounting thing. You have to beware of investing in companies and funds that promise the moon, and the information is not transparent, not clearly evident to the public. They're trying to disguise the truth.
That's interesting. So you're saying, from your experience, looking at some of these higher net worth individuals with their successful portfolios, it seems like it's the opposite of what many of us would suspect, where it's not like they got in really early on some new industry or some new thing like a Bitcoin. If I understand you correctly, you're saying it's actually the opposite, where the successful investors actually stay away from these hot investments that look like everyone and their mother is buying it because there's no way, there's only one way to go and that's up. Sounds like from your experience, that's actually been the opposite. Did I understand that correctly?
Absolutely.
That's fascinating. Yeah, because when you go on, whether it's investing shows on YouTube or any sort of podcast with active investing, it almost sounds like it's the opposite story being pitched, right? Where, oh, you want to get in early on this hot new thing, and that's what's going to make your return skyrocket. And so it's fascinating to hear from your, like I said, 30 plus years of experience, how looking at people's portfolios, it's actually the opposite. Is tends to be, obviously there's going to be some winners in those other ones too, but it seems like that's more of a rare thing. The more common thing is you actually just avoid those altogether. And Warren Buffett's always a good example when it comes to that, for sure. Yeah. That's great. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. The narrative you hear in all the business news and all of that. What are your thoughts on how someone should shift their portfolio once they reach financial independence and would like to retire? In other words, moving from the asset accumulation phase to the asset decumulation phase, where they are now looking to live off their portfolio. Are there any changes they should make? And if so, what kind?
It's a very good question. And we're all facing that, gradually increasing the income objective. But the word is gradually. I still look at total returns being the most important, just income and capital gain growth is really my goal. But as we age and as we retire, you want to have more in income producing securities. But it's very important not just to buy a fund that's a dividend paying fund without analyzing the fund itself. Many dividend funds, and I've researched this, only focus on the absolute dividend yield. So they buy only high dividend paying securities, but they don't focus on the sustainability of the dividend or the growth of the dividend or the quality of the company in terms of their earnings and cash flow and the ability of the company to increase the dividend and have a, you call it a low dividend payout. So they have the ability to increase the dividend without borrowing money. So yes, I definitely believe in dividend paying securities, but I also want to buy a dividend paying securities that increase their dividends each year. But I also invest in companies that are not dividend paying, that have some growth, such as Uber, such as Amazon, because you need some growth as well. Even the ones that are on a limited income, they still need some growth in their portfolio. They can't get it all from dividends. You have some growth. Like, for example, TELUS is a company that has got a very strong dividend, but look at the share price. It's collapsed. Now, the reason it's collapsed is because interest rates have risen. But it's also collapsed because the TELUS International business is not doing as well as they thought it was going to do. There's much more competition. So it's struggling. So just buying a stock based on the dividend alone is dangerous. I don't want to get a 5% dividend, but lose 10% on the share price. Because I look at both. And I think all investors need to look at both.
Yeah, I think it's easy to get used to seeing when we're looking at like high interest savings accounts or GICs, and you just see how much you're going to get, and you're so focused on that income piece. But then if you apply that sort of thinking to individual stocks as well, then it sounds like from what you're saying, yeah, you can get in some pretty hot water where, okay, it's got this high dividend yield, but it could be very short-lived. And then you end up actually hurting on the total return side, which is ultimately what you care the most about. Very interesting.
Yeah, like for example, Algonquin Power, which is a utility, supposedly good quality, but they cut their dividend because they got too much in debt, interest rates rose too quickly, and they were borrowing to pay the dividend. And investors need to do their homework just to determine if a company is borrowing to pay that dividend. As if they're borrowing, that's not sustainable, particularly when interest rates are so high as they are today.
And now a quick message from one of our sponsors. There are so many opinions on how to invest your money today, but it can be hard to find credible voices to rely on in the world of finance and investing. One resource I turn to every week is the ETF Market Insights YouTube channel, led by today's episode sponsor, BMO ETFs. Market Insights brings in industry experts, and their weekly episodes cover the hottest themes like inflation, infrastructure, healthcare, and more. Tuning in helps me stay up to date on what's happening so I can be a smarter investor. And you can also submit your own ETF questions to be answered on the show. So do yourself a favor and subscribe on YouTube to ETF Market Insights or visit etfmarketinsights.com so you can be notified when future episodes go live. Now, speaking with you so far, clearly you're more on the active side of things where you're picking your own stocks, picking your own fixed income investments, as opposed to just buying something like an asset allocation ETF and just calling it a day. And yes. So I'd love to get your thoughts on what made you decide to go that route, being more on the active side as opposed to just taking sort of simpler, more passive approach. What are the, just to kind of get listeners' perspective in terms of the pros and cons of going the approach that you decided to take?
It's all to do with risk. I said before, in an up market, I'm not trying to outperform the index, but I'm trying to outperform the index in a down market. So having and being proactive in terms of asset mix, say, for example, we're about to have a recession. We've been saying this for the longest period of time, but to say if we're actually accurate in some ways, we're having an economic slowdown, but not necessarily a recession. Do you want to be maximize equity? And do you want to be in the high risk equities, high beta equities or not? So you can be proactive in terms of that. If the evidence is clear, we're going to have a deep recession, which clearly is not the case now at all, where the likelihood of even a shallow recession is more likely. But if you're going to expect to have a deep recession, you can reduce your equities, you can reduce your high beta equities, you can increase your cash and your fixed income. So you can make modest changes, not dramatic change. And that is value over time. I had a friend many years ago that was fully invested in the 2008, 2009 recession, because he thought the most important thing was income for him because he was retired. And I said, no, you've got to have some cash to give you some flexibility to rebalance when the market goes down. He said, no. So when the market went down, he said he didn't sell, but it took him 10 years to break even. 10 years. And as my wife said to me many times, when you invest in a dividend stock, who's to say the dividend won't be cut? Even though you're relying on the dividend, in a recession could easily be cut. So it is important to have some type of active asset mix strategy as opposed to passive. Now, you're saying that that's a tactical asset mix, and I do happen to agree with that anyway, that ETF, that type of thing. I do agree with that approach, but I also agree with risk parameters and transparency of what you're invested in at any one time, what your asset mix is and what your risk is. This way, I'm more active.
That's good to know. Yeah, it's interesting. I like to get people of different perspectives on the podcast. And a lot of times when I talk to investors who are more on the active investing side instead of the passive, the reasoning is there's no MER if you're buying the stock directly. So there you go, you save on that. And yeah, if you play your cards right, you can actually beat the index. And so it's from the lens of, I can get higher returns if I'm able to pull this off successfully. And so it's really interesting to hear your perspective where it's actually not all about maximizing the returns as much as I possibly can. And that's why I'm being active and devoting all this extra time to it. It's more so from the, if I do it correctly, I can actually limit my downside even more than just being a pure total market index investor. So that's very interesting. It's like I said, it's nice to hear different perspectives, pros and cons, and different approaches, yeah, and why you chose to go that route. Great. Now, I noticed, speaking of how you invest, I noticed that you do have a monthly investment newsletter where you make investment recommendations. What type of investing is this? What type of investor is this for?
It's for basically everyone. It's really to get away from using an advisor. You can do it yourself. You can save a lot of money. I have two model portfolios. There's 50 to 55 names in each one, Canadian and US. I have some fixed income ETFs. I have some individual bonds as well. I have money market ones, different money market instruments as well. So you can actually run the portfolio that way. And it also I have every month an asset mix recommendation for each portfolio and an equity sector recommendation. And I also provide the strategy during the month, as well as at the end of the month on a particular stock, particular sector, asset mix, whatever case may be. So I'm actively managing it on a daily basis.
What are your thoughts on using preferred shares and options in our portfolios? Can you take us through the pros and cons, and who are those types of investments best suited for? I did get a few questions on that from listeners of the show, so I thought I would pick your brain since you seem to be more on that side.
Rightly call options, I'm comfortable with. But the negative of them is that you're probably going to be, the stock is going to eventually be sold, you know, if the stock goes up. So it will increase your commissions, your transaction fee in the end. And more often than not, I see myself included buying back that option at a higher price because I like the stock and I don't want to be taken out of the stock. But I understand it adds value in terms of income and it's a low risk strategy. So I do like that approach, but I don't use it that often, but I do use it. Preference, on the other hand, I do not like. I had a lady who was a member of a shirt club in Ottawa come to me and she was in her 80s. And she said her advisor put her into 5 prefers and she lost 50% of the value of the money. And she didn't know what, and that's all he recommended. She said, what do I do? Well, she waited too long, over 5 years, so you couldn't do anything anyway. But no advisor should ever put them in only one asset class in the first place. But preferreds are very, I don't like them per se. They're a retail product. Pension funds tend not to buy them because pension funds are, it's a non-taxable account. Those are very illiquid. Secondly, the quality is not always that good. Thirdly, the research is almost zero. There's an older gentleman who's very knowledgeable. I can't remember his name. He's a preferred expert in Canada. He's sitting in a rocking chair. He analyzes his prefers to death, but he seems to be the only person really doing the analysis of prefers. And he's getting on in age. And they're also very volatile, not long-term holds. Comparing them to common stocks tend to increase their dividends over time as long as you buy good quality. Preferreds don't increase them all. Rate reset preferreds are one example of most of the preferreds today are rate reset preferred. And the rate is reset every 5 years. So if interest rates go down, they get hurt. That older lady saw her price decline as a preferred as rates went down. Perpetual preferreds are the opposite to like long bonds. They only go up when rates go down. But when rates go up, they get clobbered because they're long duration and they're most volatile. So both rate reset and perpetual are dangerous. And the public is not really aware of this. They think they're just a very conservative yield plot because they rank higher than the common stocks in terms of bankruptcy. But that doesn't mean they're good quality because they're not. I don't like the group at all. I played them, but there is research on the discount brokerage side, but it requires so much analysis that I'm a fundamental analyst on CFA, and I have trouble doing the analysis on prefers. And so how could the average investor without a financial background possibly understand them? Well, that's why I don't want.
Yeah, the whole golden rule of only investing in things you actually understand. And then if you try to apply that to preferred, and it's, like you said, you're a CFA, and if you're having trouble with it, then that's kind of a bit of a flag, I think, for a lot of people where, okay, maybe this is not the kind of investment be right for them. That's great. Well, thank you for sharing your expertise and your opinion with us. Like I said, it's really nice to get different views, different opinions for us on the show, especially sometimes those that actually do invest differently than what I do myself, for example, just to sort of give us a better understanding of the pros and cons of these different approaches and these different ways to invest. Where can we learn more from you? And can you tell everyone where we can get your book as well for those interested?
Well, my newsletter, first of all, is McBurtry Investment Report. It's online and it's by subscription. I have a lot of free samples online as well, you can see. My book is available online. Own Your Financial Future, take advantage of the knowledge that lives here. Own Your Financial Future, take charge of your investments right here. It's on Amazon.ca. Now, my book is all about the logistics of investing. How to invest, how to set up a discount broker account, how to take your money away from high-cost mutual funds into either individual securities or low-cost ETFs, how to do that without paying maximum amount of deferred sales charges. There is a methodology of doing that. How to analyze the stock, the fundamental analysis I'm talking about, what to look for, how to set up and manage an asset mix, an investment portfolio, how to read financial things, which is something that is very important, and what specific fundamental analysis do I use when I look at a company or an industry. Basically, if I'm looking at a company, the first thing I look at is the industry that they're in. And if they're in an industry that's cyclical, where are we in the economic cycle? And are we going to get a severe recession or not? Because no company, even if it's the best company in the world, if the industry is in trouble, do you want to invest in an industry at that time? You have to be careful. So we look at all of that, but I look at the fundamentals of the company, the revenues, the earnings, the cash flow, the balance sheet. And as I said, earnings per share revisions, which I use consensus earnings estimates, they're all available on the discount brokerage site for every company going out. But there's also something called earnings per share revisions, which the consensus estimates are revised every month. And even if the number is going to go up 10% of the company earnings per share next year, has that 10% number gone down in the last week or two, or has it gone up? And that's also important, the trend in the number, as opposed to the number itself. So I look at all of these numbers to get a fundamental picture of a company. So when someone falls to me and says, look, this stock is a potential takeover, I'm not looking at it from the point of view of that. Is it good value relative to its peer, or is it not good value? Do they have good earnings growth, revenue growth, or do they not? And a takeover of a company that's in trouble, I don't play that game. I don't want to play that game. So I don't. But I look at the fundamentals. And so my book is all about looking at the logistics of, you can understand how to read a financial statement, all these things, but you do not have to be, have a financial background to do it.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Peter, and thanks for coming on. And I'll be sure to link out to your book and to your website in the show notes of podcast as well. And yeah, thanks for coming on and for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you very kindly. And I wanted to say how much I really appreciate your questions. They're very thoughtful and intelligent questions, and I really appreciate that. And your webcast and your podcast are terrific.
Awesome. Thank you.
Because you're providing such value to your readership.
Thanks so much, Peter. That means a lot. I definitely put a lot of thought into the questions, so it's nice. It's nice to hear that that payoff. So yeah. Great. So thanks so much, Peter. And like I said, I'll be sure to link up to everything. And yeah, definitely some really new insights for me from this conversation. So thank you for that. And until we chat again, take care.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. All right. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share it with someone that you think may find it useful. And of course, leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify is always super appreciated as well. I'd like to end with a big thanks to one of our sponsors who, apart from my investing course, literally keeps the entire Build Wealth Canada podcast and website free for you. Do you know why asset allocation ETFs have become so popular? Asset allocation explains over 90% of the variation in a portfolio's quarterly return. So it's no wonder Canadian investors are turning to these ETFs. Today's sponsor, BMO ETFs, offers these innovative all-in-one solutions with the BMO All Equity ETF, ZEQT, the BMO Growth ETF, ZGRO, the BMO Balanced ETF, ZBAL, and the BMO Conservative ETF, ZCON, and many more. BMO developed these to help provide investors with ETFs that offer broad diversification and are also low cost and simple to use. These ETFs invest in a number of underlying index-based ETFs and are rebalanced automatically back to your set asset allocation or mix of stocks and bonds. They offer a hands-free approach to investing that is built on disciplined weights to provide exposure to different geographies and sectors all in one solution. BMO actually offers 8 asset allocation ETFs, and you can learn more at bmoetfs.com.
Thanks for listening to the Build Wealth Canada podcast at www.buildwealthcanada.ca.